Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of NationalReview.com. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America, and we will have plenty of debt ceiling talk here in the next several minutes. And Jim, our good martini for today is certainly not the deal, but it is some analysis we saw from an unlikely source, someone who actually works for NBC. And that is Jim Cramer. We referenced him in passing last week. He's the host of Mad Money, and he was at a considerably lower decibel level as a panelist on Meet the Press. But David Gregory, the moderator, asked him about the role that Obama's played here, and here's what Cramer had to say.
He came out and panicked the heck out of us. He talked about the higher interest rates for mortgages. He talked the spike in credit card. He talked about how hard it's going to be to get a student loan. It took us all aback because we felt that he'd be a compromise leader. Instead, he created tremendous fear.
And what did that lead to?
Tremendous fear means uncertainty. Uncertainty means no spending. Uncertainty means no spending by businesses. It means no hiring. It was a setback. But he caused the panic, not the media.
But Tom,
I guess the extra good part here, Jim, is that despite all that attempt to panic the world, the markets really didn't respond the way the administration was hoping. They actually took it pretty much all in stride to this point, and right now they're up because they think there's going to be a deal here. But actually, somebody who works for NBC, who believes that the president does deserve a lot of the blame here, is kind of a shocking pleasantry. I assume he's going to be bunking with Mark Halperin pretty soon.
You know, it's one of those things. I've actually always kind of liked Jim Cramer. I don't understand half of what he says, but I think any guy who brings that much passion to what he does and tries to take what can be a very dry topic of economics and business in the markets and tries to make it interesting fun. It's easy to forget in like early in Obama's administration, I want to say like February, March 2009, when the markets were really starting to go down, partially out of the preceding a hangover from the previous 6 months and other jitters over Obama's stepping into office. Cramer called it as he said it, and he had been a supporter of Obama in 08. He thought he had the best plans, and he was not confident. And it was at that moment that John Stewart suddenly started making fun of him. And it was one of those things where I was like, aha, Cramer has always had this manic, over-the-top, wild and crazy, you know, entertaining style. One time on Hannity, I described him as, he's like, for people who find Glenn Beck too calming and relaxing. Now, you know, but all of a sudden, once he starts criticizing Obama, then everybody's got to take him out of the kneecap. So the idea of Cramer coming out and being critical is not totally stunning, and I think it, you know, represents his honest opinion. I think what really is probably, you know, where I could almost hear the, I don't know if it's steam coming out of David Gregory's ears, but, you know, the rest of the table probably flinching as he says that is because, remember, this is no drama Obama. This is Mr. Cool. This is the guy who's supposed to be the Mr. Fix-It. And Cramer's making the argument, I think rather compellingly, that Obama's belief to this is the same thing, philosophy he's had towards a lot of problems in his presidency, which was, you know, the Rahm Emanuel statement of never let a crisis go to waste. Now, it's often been shortened to never waste a crisis. I look at the way the Obama administration worked and conclude that the real lesson is never solve a crisis. Particularly came to me during that whole Deepwater Horizon oil spill. It just seemed to go on forever. Obama believes that each crisis, each time there's a major problem coming down the road, that's a chance for him to get what he wants. And it's always some variation of, you remember what I was saying 3 weeks ago, this is why I need it. You know, if the economy is booming, we should be raising hikes. If the economy is struggling, we should be raising taxes on the richest people. Corporate jets are always to blame. ATMs are always to blame. Unsurprisingly, the Wall Street crowd is unimpressed. And I think that those of us in the political realm, something that's kind of an interesting lesson of this whole process, we may overestimate how much influence Washington has over the markets. Last week I was hearing from very smart guys who probably made more money than I'm ever going to make in my life, who basically were saying, you know what, the market has priced most of this in. And I'd say so far, when you know, I saw the headline, markets are soaring, Asian markets are soaring, they've soared 1.8%. That's good, you know, better than the other way. And I'm sure that once a market gets large enough, that each change on a day-to-day basis is going to get smaller. But, you know, soar, you would get an idea of big jumps, and I'm not sure 1.8% is that much. So the lesson of all of this is that the markets have kind of priced in a lot of this whole back-and-forth stuff. The fact that we're not having a collapse is good news. The fact that the markets aren't impressed with Obama is good news from where we sit. But I think that's a good segue to the second martini because there's a lot to not like in this, Greg.
Absolutely right. And we'll try to distill it as quickly as possible so we have time for our stellar third martini as well. This deal is probably, as you and I were discussing off the air, Jim, it's probably the best you can do, and it's completely unacceptable. So when you look at it, you've got $1 trillion in spending cuts over 10 years, and the president saying directly, well, look, we don't want to impact this all in the fragile economy at once, so not much is going to happen here in the next year or so, basically meaning that this will be completely unenforceable in future Congresses. You've got this supposed super congressional committee that a lot of folks believe is just going to lead to tax increases of one form or another. And in the end, you'll have a balanced budget amendment that's you don't have to pass. They'll probably vote on it. And all it will do is allow embattled Democrats like Claire McCaskill and the Nelsons from Nebraska and Florida to say they're for it when they know it's not going to pass. So hard to understand what happened here. I still think, despite his best intentions, John Boehner made a huge mistake in self-watering down the Republican plan before the Senate did anything.
The one thing I'm going to say, sort of in Boehner's defense, is that in his interpretation of things, that's one of the things that kind of threw me off last night, was you listen to what Obama's describing the deal as and what Boehner's talking as a deal as, and you wonder if they agreed on the same thing. Because that, you know, they just sounded like completely, you know, it's not just the usual spin. I mean, my first question was, does the bill cut $1 trillion or does it cut $2.4 trillion? And the answer is, it cuts $1 trillion or 900, close to $1 trillion over the next 10 years out of discretionary spending. But it's backloaded and it's over the next 10 years. So really we're talking about $100 billion per year, you know, with more towards the later. And my attitude towards all these deals is the more realistic they are, the more they do the hard stuff first. Because along the line, you can always find excuses to not do the hard stuff that you put off later. So right. Remember the wonderful parable of Sasha and Malia. You know, good children don't procrastinate, and here's a deal that kind of procrastinates on the tougher cuts. So that's issue number one. Then you've got this super committee, which from the way Boehner describes it, we're either going to get a fantastic plan out of this super committee. And by the way, you talk about it's probably going to raise taxes. He says the baseline is this, with the current circumstances. So that, you know, the only way they could raise, in other words, if they're going to raise taxes, they have to raise taxes by a ton, like in the neighborhood of $3 trillion, which is not something that, you know, any Democrat's going to want to enact before a 2012 election. Obama probably doesn't want to sign that into law right before the election. And Lord knows you're not going to get Republicans voting for that. So, conceivably, tax hikes are going to be off the table, at least in Boehner's mindset. If they don't reach a deal, you get across the board cuts, except for Social Security, except for Medicaid and Medicare, I think, except for defense spending, and except for veterans and military pay and civil pay, which to me says it's not really an across-the-board cut once you exempt all these things. But anyway, their idea is that we're either going to get an across-the-board cut making up that extra $1.4 trillion, or we'll get a fantastic deal out of the super committee. I wish, if it does come to that, well done, Speaker Boehner, that'll be really great. I just have this nagging feeling, and as I put this on Twitter this morning, every time we try to put a financial straitjacket on the federal government, they turn into Harry Houdini. They find some sort of amazing way to, oh, well, we didn't expect the economy was bad, and they'll undo it. So my nagging doubt is that something that we don't know yet in this process is going to go wrong. Perhaps some people will say that's cynicism. But you know what? Past history provides a lot of fodder for cynicism in federal budgetary matters.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. The fact that the House GOP is a backstop to whatever the super committee could do gives me a little bit of peace. I think if Republicans wanted to get the Tea Party on board, they'd announce who their conferees are at this point. And I would personally nominate Senators Lee, DeMint, and Rubio to make sure that there wouldn't be any squishies over there in the Senate like there was in the Gang of Six. And I think we can probably choose from a pretty long list of folks who will not be in any way inclined to raise taxes on the House side. So I think if McConnell were to do something like that, he'd probably ease a few concerns. But in the end, with the folks who monitor the bond rating saying we needed to cut about $4 trillion over 10 years to prevent a bond rating drop no matter what we do here in the next 24 to 48 hours, well done, everybody, being $3 trillion short, even if those cuts actually materialize.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth noting that, again, you know, for all of our whacking around Speaker Boehner like a pinata, you know, maybe this really is the very best deal you can get with Reid and Obama. I mean, in other words, like maybe this, you know, if we really want to do anything serious, there's really nothing that can be done until 2012. Having said that, when I heard the $1 trillion number, it just was a disappointingly low one. We'll see what happens after that. We got to see how much of this comes out of defense, et cetera. But I'm surprised to see anybody celebrating over this. It's anybody that, you know, exuberant over a deal like this.
Exactly. Well, on now to number three. the crazy martini. And kudos, of course, always to the Secret Service for all the great work they do in protecting the president and the first family and the vice president and his family. Not really sure, though, Jim, that the Secret Service should be paying the vice president rent to stay in his cottage so they're in closer proximity to his place in Wilmington, Delaware. This was reported by the Washington Times. It was a cottage that Biden's mother lived in until she passed away last year. Then he rented it out again. He suggested that the Secret Service rent it out. Not the Secret Service saying, oh, no, we can't take it pro bono, sir. We have to pay rent. But Joe Biden offering to take their rent money from them. Very classy.
What a swell guy. You know, as I heard that story, I was reminded of Richard Ben Cramer wrote a book about the 1988 presidential race called What It Takes. And there's all kinds of portraits. And, you know, running in for president in 1988 was Joe Biden. And it's a very vivid depiction of Joe Biden. He's kind of an interesting life story, some very tragic chapters in this. But there's very much this, like, you know, aggressive salesman to Joe Biden who always, well, I'm going to get you the best deal. It's the very best thing. And he bought a house and he was, you know, talking about how swell it was. And it's a little bit of a fixer-upper, but it's going to be fantastic. And the guy who was his real estate agent says, you know, if you really fix it up, it could be, you know, you might be able to get close to $1 million for it. And so Biden immediately starts talking and says, I got a $1 million house. His agent's like, no. I said, you could get perhaps close to $1 million. And of course, you know, Biden immediately says, oh, it's $1 million easy. So be wary of Joe Biden in real estate matters. That's kind of the lesson of that one. To say nothing of when he's disclosing, you know, secret hideaways and other things in the vice presidential residence that he did earlier in this administration. So it's that wacky Joe. I thought Sheriff Joe was the guy who kept everybody else in line. So I'm surprised that the Secret Service needs to do such. I think if there's a way for him to waive those fees, it would be very wise and, you know, look very good and all that stuff. Because really, they are willing to take a bullet for you.
Exactly.
You know? So, as if that's not enough. At the very least, that's what you say this to the vice president, you have this feeling, all right, you take a bullet for me, I'll knock 10% off.
Yeah. So far he's collected about $13,000 and he's listed on the federal purchasing documents as vendor. So I'm sure this is all on the up and up. Jim, have a great day. We'll have more tomorrow.
What a great start to the week, Greg. Can't wait for tomorrow.
Great. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. He's Jim Garrity of NationalReview.com. Please join us Tuesday for the next edition of the Three Martini Lunch.